Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Wednesday, October 14th, 2015, the morning after the first Democratic debate of presidential candidates held in Las Vegas. Who are the winners? Who are the losers? I think that the Clinton and Sanders campaigns can declare victory after the first debate. I think both those candidates held their own, did very well, didn't make any serious blunders. Each took a few jabs, but didn't hit the floor. And let me begin by criticizing the way CNN managed this debate. Anderson Cooper was the lead moderator, and he occasionally handed it off to Dana Bash and to two other people. But it's like he had had a six-pack of Red Bull, and he was interruptive and very combative. And he began the proceedings with a series of gotcha questions. I thought the first round was like a smackdown. And instead of, you know, saying, what are the key issues, why are you qualified to be president, he had a gotcha question for each of the candidates. And I didn't run a stopwatch, but it seemed he spent the first 10, 12, maybe even 15 minutes just going back and forth between Clinton and Sanders, ignoring the other three candidates on the stage. But when he did include O'Malley and Webb and Chafee, it was a similar approach. The first question is always a real negative, aggressive question. And despite that tone, the candidates did not really respond in kind. They didn't go into the Republican mode of name-calling, of putting down other candidates, trivializing or marginalizing immigrants, brown people, black people, poor people. And so it really was the candidates and not the network or the moderator who set a tone which made for a debate that I thought was okay. And yesterday in my News and Comment podcast, I raised questions about whether they would really cover the issues that matter most to me. And the one thing that wasn't discussed by anyone is closing Guantanamo and the torture history of the United States and the failure to prosecute those people. But there were good questions and some interesting answers about the war in Syria, about the Patriot Act, about surveillance, about a lot of things that matter to me. And I give Bernie Sanders credit. He's a no-nonsense, humorless guy. And all the other candidates opening statements were warm and fuzzy things that involved kids and grandkids and wives and loved ones. Bernie never mentioned his wife or his son or anything about his own background. He just started hitting away about class issues, trying to restore the middle class in the United States. And I think he was very effective. Now, Bernie has his own little approach. He tends to yell and wave his arms around a lot. And in contrast, Clinton came off as cooler, smoother, but less passionate and more detached. And in the hours since the debate ended, I have a note here that 1.3 million people have made donations averaging $29 to the Sanders campaign. Now, he did put in a plug. He was the only one who said, come on over and donate some money, gave his website address. But Sanders also distinguished himself by being the one who voted against the Patriot Act and still stands firm for that position. And he flatly said, domestic surveillance, I'd shut down what exists right now. It's that virtually every telephone call in this country ends up in a file at the NSA. That is unacceptable to me. He also defended Ed Snowden. And he was asked a kind of gotcha question, Snowden, hero or traitor? And he didn't take the bait. He simply said, I think Snowden played a very important role in educating the American people to the degree to which our civil liberties are being undermined. And he said that while Snowden did break the law, that he would bring him home. In contrast, Hillary Clinton said he broke the laws of the United States. He stole very important information that's unfortunately fallen into a lot of the wrong hands. So I don't think he should be brought home without facing the music. She also floated the false notion that he could have gotten protection as a whistleblower. And she knows that's bullshit. And she said a lot of things that are inconsistent with her long-held positions. And she talked about evolving and changing and learning, and some of that is understandable. But I think Hillary was successful in positioning herself as almost as liberal as Bernie Sanders. She drew the line at socialism and references to Denmark. But Sanders held his own. When the gotcha question about his self-described socialist leanings was popped on him, and he didn't flinch. He said, you know, that he's basically proud of his long-term positions, and that income inequality, wealth inequality, and Citizens United and the role of corrupt money in our political system are things that need to be fixed. And if that makes him a socialist, kind of so be it. Now, of course, the soundbite, the video clip that will be used forever to identify this particular debate is when Hillary was being grilled by Anderson Cooper about her emails. And she offered a pretty quick explanation. She said she made a mistake using a private server but defended her judgment. And then Cooper, hoping that Bernie Sanders was going to go for her jugular, gave him the floor. And that's where Sanders upstaged Cooper, Clinton, and everybody else. And while I think politically it was a good move for him, as I'll explain in a moment, I deplore what he did. He said, "Let me say something that may not be great politics, but I think the secretary is right, and that is that the American people are sick and tired of hearing about your damn emails." Cheers erupted. Hillary breaks out into a smile, reaches over to shake Bernie's hand. Thank you, me too," she says. "Me too." Well, I believe that me too is her mantra. She's looked at all of Bernie's policy positions about paying for college tuition, about Medicare for all, single-payer health care, about fixing the middle class, ending bad trade deals, and her whole approach has been, if Bernie said it, it's me too. And last night she actually said, me too, to Bernie Sanders. And the reason I deplore this is while I think it was a brilliant political stroke by Sanders, it made him a statesman who refused to attack his opponent, and he used it to try to refocus on the issues that are in his wheelhouse about the middle class, wealth and income inequality, that's what the American people want to talk about, not the damn emails. But Hillary Clinton needs to explain, not so much about the server and her choice to, not use government facilities for her communications. That's pretty well been aired out. But I believe that these emails tell us a lot. Last week, I shared the story of Joe Wilson and Valerie Plame, who did a TV commercial endorsing Hillary in 2008, and then Joe Wilson turned around and lobbied her as Secretary of State, won a $60 million-plus grant for a company that he was a paid consultant to build a power plant in Tanzania. Hillary shows up for the ribbon cutting at the power plant in Tanzania. And it was all greased by Sidney Blumenthal, the Clinton family fixer, who was on the Clinton Foundation payroll for $10,000 a month. Now, that shows that the Clintons freely use government to benefit their friends. And I believe that there's going to be more stuff like that in the future emails that'll be released. And so I'm not ready to write that off and say that, the American people are tired of hearing about the damn emails. I'm tired of seeing this kind of, conflict of interest that has played out. And remember, Hillary and Bill Clinton both said they would not accept contributions from foreign governments while she was Secretary of State, and they took millions of dollars into the Clinton Foundation despite that. And when Hillary talked about being the senator from Wall Street, and she told him to cut it out back in 2007, well, that doesn't wash when you know that just last year she took, I believe it was $250,000 or more for a single speech to Goldman Sachs. And when Hillary said, I'm a progressive, but I'm a progressive who likes to get things done. I know how to find common ground, but I know how to stand my ground. She repeated that one several times in a Tammy Wynette chorus. Now, the weakest point for Bernie Sanders was when he was asked about his position on gun laws. And he is vulnerable on this. He'll tell you he's from Vermont, a state that had no gun control, and despite that, he supported the assault weapons ban. And he wants to brag that he has a D-minus rating from the NRA. But Hillary hit him pretty hard on this, and I think scored some points. Now, to the others on the stage, I was very interested in seeing Governor Martin O'Malley, former governor of Maryland. And while he's articulate, he's attractive, he's younger than everybody else on the stage, doesn't have some of the baggage of other people, he hurt his candidacy in a number of places, particularly when he was asked the biggest threat to the United States. He said a nuclear, Iran with a nuclear weapon, something to that effect. And Jim Webb marginalized himself by taking a lot of neocon Republican positions, including his opposition to the nuclear deal with Iran. And he repeated the false talking point that the Obama deal, and it's not Obama's deal, it's the P5 plus one, it's an international agreement, that it essentially paves the way for Iran to get a nuclear weapon. That's an Israeli talking point. Jim Webb repeated the idea that, Israel is our biggest ally in the whole wide world. And Lincoln Chafee, who I've talked with and met once before, and he's anomaly. He is anomalous, an anomaly. He was a moderate Republican. Then he became an independent when he ran for governor of Rhode Island. And now he has rebranded as a Democrat. And he was mainly promoting that he has been ethically above board and never caught up in a scandal. And that was, of course, a direct hint and inference against Hillary Clinton. But he got caught up in his vote for the repeal of Glass-Steagall, which he now regrets, and he tried to explain it as well. It was my first vote when I was appointed to the Senate after my father died. And I think that was a very, very weak answer. A couple of other things. Bernie Sanders took very strong positions about repealing Citizens United. You can't really repeal it. You have to overturn it with a constitutional amendment. And opposing the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And to her credit, Hillary got worked up at one point and slammed Republicans who are always opposed to big government except when it works in their favor. He says they don't mind having big government interfere with a woman's right to choose or when it comes to taking down Planned Parenthood. And on that, I agree with her, and I'm glad she spoke up. Now, sadly, there are five more debates planned, and many of them are going to be at times that most people won't be able to see them, on the weekends or in off hours. And that's part of a concocted plan by Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the chair of the Democratic National Committee. She thinks that's going to help Hillary. And I don't think Hillary needs protection from these debates. And so I hope the Democratic leadership will rethink that. And speaking of campaign finance reform, Sunday's New York Times lead story on the front page reads thusly, half the cash for the 16 race is coming from only 158 families. And it opens this way. They are overwhelmingly white, wealthy, older, and male in a nation that's being remade by the young, by women, by black and brown voters. Across a sprawling country, they reside in the archipelago of wealth, exclusive neighborhoods dotting a handful of cities and towns. And in an economy that has minted billionaires in a dizzying array of industries, most made their fortunes in just two, finance and energy. Just 158 families, along with the companies they own or control, contributed $176 million in the first phase of the campaign. The oligarchy that Sanders talks about is very real. And I think that that is the way he connects with American voters. It's getting interesting, folks. And I really thank Bernie Sanders for making this a race instead of a coronation for Hillary Rodham Clinton. One thing the candidates talked about, and nobody really distinguished themselves, is the war in Syria and Iraq. There was consensus, and Hillary made the curious statement, nobody wants to see American troops in Syria. Now, that's not a flat-out statement that she will never put U.S. troops in Syria. She said nobody wants to see it. And Sanders embraced the failed policy of the Obama administration, which was labeled by the New York Times recently as incoherent and hallucinatory. He said, yeah, we won't put troops in, but I support Obama's bombing raids in Syria and Iraq. Well, Vladimir Putin not responding to the debate, but he criticized the U.S. and others Tuesday for what he said is their lack of cooperation with the Russian military campaign in Syria. Now, just before he made these comments, the Russians conducted airstrikes on 86 of 88 intended targets of the Islamic State. Now, this is a big shift because they've been widely criticized for targeting U.S.-backed rebel groups in Syria. But the wily Vlad Putin said that recently we've offered the Americans, give us objects that we shouldn't target. No answer. It seems to me that some of our partners have mush for brains. He complained that while the Russian government had asked for the coordinates of the groups that should or should not be attacked, the U.S. has not responded to either request. Now, I can understand this. We don't trust Putin. And we think, well, if we tell him the groups we want to protect, he'll target them. And if we give him our intel on where the Islamic State is, he might use it more for his own purposes than for any mutual aim. And so I think that, again, Putin has the upper hand in this exchange because the U.S. policy has been so ridiculous. We'll continue to watch that for you. Meanwhile, there is pushback in Syria against the Russians. There was a rally held at the Russian embassy in Damascus on Tuesday. And while those protesters or activists were out there with signs supporting Putin and thanking him for attacking Syria, rebel forces, we're not sure which of the 41 groups, hurled shells at the group. No one was hurt. But the al-Nusra Front is threatening Russia with attacks in the Caucasus and other Russian republics. And so Russia, Mother Russia, may be paying a price that it didn't expect. Over to our great ally, Saudi Arabia. As you know, the U.S. expresses what I call selective outrage when the Islamic State beheads people for propaganda video purposes. And I'm sure you have no doubt that, I find that deeply offensive and barbaric. But our great ally, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, is on the verge of executing a teenager who's guilty of protesting and encouraging others to protest. And they want to kill him by first beheading him and then crucifying him. He was 17 at the time. It's been a couple of years. His name is Nusra al-Ahmed. Oh, I'm sorry, that's his mother's name. The young man is Ali Muhammad al-Nimr, N-I-M-R. And we've heard outcry from Bill Maher, the British Prime Minister, David Cameron, Amnesty International, Reprieve. But the Saudi government says, this is not your business. Do not interfere in the private affairs of the kingdom. And his mother has gotten a little bit more verbal. She said, I was afraid for my son, but inside I agreed with him in principle. After his arrest, she alleged he'd been tortured. When I visited my son for the first time, I didn't recognize him. I didn't know whether this really was my son, Ali, or not. I could clearly see a wound on his forehead, another on his nose. They disfigured it. He told me that he'd been kicked, slapped, his teeth fell out. For a month, he was peeing blood. And she's calling on President Obama, who she thinks is the top leader in the world, to prevail upon the Saudis to stop this ugly execution plan. And the Brits have weighed in the Al Nimr case, and also in the case of a British national who has lived in Saudi Arabia for 25 years. His name is Carl Andree. He's 74 years old, a former oil executive, and he has been actually convicted and may be sentenced to 350 lashes with a whip. His offense is he made homemade alcohol in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And the Saudi princes drink like fish when they're outside the country and get in a lot of trouble, but they impose the ban on alcohol on everybody else in their kingdom. Every day I like to take a moment to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. And today I want to single out Andy Krieger, Annette McManus, Andy Krieger again, and Joe Carson. And yes, Andy Krieger is one of the generous people who has more than one subscription. He's got one for $5 a month and another for $10 a month. And Joe Carson, our friend the whistleblower in Tennessee, he kicks in $10 a month very generously, and I really appreciate that. And because I was away for most of September, and then we went through a website upgrade, I mentioned yesterday, we have had a decline in traffic of people accessing the podcast every day. So I'd like to ask you, my stalwart regular listeners, to make a point to share this with friends via email, put it up on Facebook and share it that way. Click that like button. It makes a big difference. If you use the Twitter machine, go ahead and tweet it out. And there are many other ways that you can share my work with people that you think are like-minded. And I'd appreciate it if you do that. We need to rebuild the traffic and generate some new subscriptions because revenue has dropped here as well. And so I need your help. Help me out any way you can, okay? And if you don't have a subscription now, I'd be delighted if you become one of the next subscribers. Visit peterbcollins.com. Click on the menu button in the upper right. Next button you click on is Become a Subscriber. There you get to choose $5, $10, $20 a month, a one-time contribution, the $50 annual. You can go to the Apple App Store and pick up the PBC app for the iPhone and the iPad. There are just so many ways that you can connect and support, and I really appreciate everything that you do to help further what I'm doing here. Chelsea Manning, the imprisoned WikiLeaks whistleblower and a political prisoner, has filed a lawsuit against the Department of Justice to try to force the FBI to release the documents that they have collected on Chelsea Manning. Now, as you may know, there was a parallel investigation that never led to any kind of criminal charges in civil or federal courts. Instead, they elected to try Chelsea Manning through the military court-martial system. And so Manning's activities, which were first brought to the attention of authorities when a hacker reported her to the FBI, is now suing to enforce a Freedom of Information Act request to get those documents. And it'll be interesting to see how the government responds. In the last 2 years, they have yet to provide a single document. They have cited a provision that exempts records or information that's been complied for law enforcement proceedings. Well, there haven't been. There aren't any contemplated. And so I call bullshit on that representation by our so-called Justice Department. And I have a letter here handwritten from Chelsea Manning in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. And let me just read a couple of lines. Thank you so very much for your thoughtful cards and letters. I wish that I could write to each and every person like you, but I just don't have the time or resources to respond to tens of thousands of letters and cards. And she says, I've been keeping myself busy with my fight for treatment to express myself as a female. And she, sorry about that, Chelsea. She thanks her lawyers for fighting so hard. And concludes by saying, I'm optimistic, still need your help to pay the bills for the very important legal cases that she is pushing forward with. So if you're so inclined, I'll put up a link to the Chelsea Manning support group, and you can kick in if you would like to. Yesterday, on the News and Comment podcast, I brought you a brief phone call with a listener who put out some very interesting criticism of yours truly over the weekend. His name is Ian, and in that conversation, Ian expressed his concern that I was kind of repeating some of the false memes that are in the media about the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, and that the media is biased in a way that typically blames the Palestinians first. And I have two examples of that for you today. I'm holding in my hand a clipping from the San Francisco Chronicle based on a Washington Post story, which is headlined, Palestinians Kill Three Israelis During Violent Day of Rage. And the headline from the New York Times, at least the online version of their latest report, Israel Bolsters Security in East Jerusalem After Violence. Well, these frame the situation as Israel being victims and responding to a violence and aggression and knife-wielding Palestinians. But as Ian very eloquently pointed out, it is the occupation, the ongoing brutal subjugation of the Palestinian people by a much more powerful nation, Israel, that is the true cause of these outbursts of violent expression. And there's an excellent commentary published at Al Jazeera today under the byline of Ahab Zaria. And it's really well argued. I'm going to link to it in the show file for this podcast. Noting a common complaint is major U.S. media outlets' characterization of neighborhoods and the legal and political context of the Israeli presence in East Jerusalem and the West Bank. The biggest problem is a total lack of context in reporting which all of this is taking place. As an example, this article cites comments that we also talked about from Philip Weiss at Mondo Weiss, that the New York Times had published a story on Monday in which the area of Pisgat Ze'ev, where two Palestinian teens were shot, one killed, one seriously injured, after stabbing a 13-year-old Jewish boy, was referred to as a section and a Jewish area of East Jerusalem. In fact, it's an Israeli settlement in East Jerusalem, which, like the rest of the West Bank, is internationally regarded as occupied territory. So the bias here is that the frame is that Israel is entitled to be on this property and that the Arabs, the Palestinians, are the other, the outlier. And it's very important to note this difference. And then it quotes Mondo Weiss saying that when referring to incidents in the territories, the New York Times fails to draw attention to the fact that those territories are occupied. And they've also called out NPR's Morning Edition for similar misleading coverage. And one final lift here from this commentary. The tendency to present the conflict as if it is involved two states or evenly matched rivals rather than one of the world's most powerful militaries and a people living under occupation. So I think it's worth considering the comments presented there. Well, I don't like to say I told you so, but I have been telling you that every time we hear about a failure of the Afghan military, that we hear American generals call to keep more U.S. troops there for a longer period of time. And the headline reads, Obama is rethinking pullout in Afghanistan, officials say. This is the whatever war. Obama can do whatever he wants, and people will just yawn and say, oh man, whatever. But it looks like he's going to break his pledge. I think it was the sixth pledge to bring home the troops from Afghanistan and leave 3,000 to 5,000 troops. And we don't know how many contractors are still there. But 5,000 troops in a sprawling nation like that simply provides targets for the Taliban and the people who now claim allegiance to the Islamic State. And we have a lot of government insiders, Madeleine Albright, Chuck Hagel, Leon Panetta, four former American ambassadors to Afghanistan, all saying that we should keep more troops in Afghanistan for a longer period of time. And I'm sorry, this is not going to work. It's been a failure for a long time, and we should recognize it. And one of the few sane voices is a former military man, a veteran of the war in Vietnam, who lost a son in the Iraq War. He's been a guest on this program several times, Andrew J. Basevich. And in a very powerful commentary that I'm linking to in the show file for this podcast, published over at Tom Dispatch, he refers to our ridiculous efforts to train up Iraqi and Afghan forces as Vietnamization 2.0. And I was astounded because I know that the figure for training the Iraqis has been about $25 billion. He says the amount we have spent trying to train the Afghans is $65 billion. But based on their performance, he writes, the security forces on which the Pentagon has lavished years of attention remain visibly not up to the job. Indeed, the United States would be better served if policymakers abandoned the pretense that the Pentagon possesses any gift whatsoever for standing up foreign military forces. Prudence might actually counsel that Washington assume instead, when it comes to organizing, training, equipping, and motivating foreign armies, that the United States is essentially clueless. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. This is the free podcast that you are free to share far and wide. I hope you will. Thank you very much for listening, and I always welcome your comments and feedback. Yes, even critical comments. You can email Peter at peterbcollins.com. Thanks, Chloe.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.